Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, here together with my co-host, Gina McAndrews. Hi, Gina.
Hello, Susan, and hello to all you listeners out there. Twice I've co-hosted with you, Susan, when we took road trips to Moingona, but this sounds like the wildest ride yet.
Well, I guess you could call it a wild ride. You know, I live in Moingona now. So the short version of today is that we'll be telling the history of the rise and fall of two historic coal towns that have links to Boone. And with the help of our guest, Mark Edwards, we'll get a little insight into some unusual political activity going on this Sunday in Boone.
Welcome, Mark, and thanks for coming into the studio today. From what I've heard, you'll have something to say about a couple of our stories we have going.
Yes, Mark, I know that you used to live in a cabin in the woods just south of the ledges, so you have more roots there than most of the people that we're going to be talking to today. Could you tell us what it was like to live out there?
Well, let's see, it's been over 40 years down there in that valley, and so I've walked a lot of it. I spent a lot of time, free time, which I had a lot of there because it cost me very little to live there. So I would work in construction and then spend most of my time outside. I learned to eat my weeds. That's how I learned to my plants. And then I kept trying to find out what had affected that valley. I was very interested how people could live there for thousands of years and what their relationship was to that place. So that's what I pursued.
Oh, and that's the beginning point of our subject today. you worked at the ledges, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I started there about 1980, and I was went on from there to work the whole state as a trails coordinator. But it was from getting in depth at that particular park because it was one of the few areas that had been protected along there before Sailorville came along and the federal government bought land in that valley.
Yeah, and actually that's one of the things that will lead into it. It's almost a theme that I could bring out with each person I spoke to, and that is how governments don't necessarily do what the citizens want them to do. And I think there was a struggle over Sailorville.
Oh, yeah, I was involved in that. There was quite a large repercussions from when we first heard of that, what that would affect. People really didn't understand, but it really focused down on flooding of the ledges because that was public space, and so that triggered a whole bunch of different things. And it also triggered the archaeological studies. So we learned a lot through David Gradwell's work there in that Sailorville, what was really there. And as we learned more, we were more concerned about what was going to happen to that area from that flooding and the dam backing up the water and all that.
I guess actually David said, well, it does flood. Yes, and it has flooded, but it's not. There was a time that they planned to have the whole lake cover it all the time. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's correct. And actually, even before Sailorville, back in the early 20s, there was a lot of discussion of building a dam right below ledges and making the whole ledges a lake all the way up to Boone. So there's been a couple different times where we've looked at flooding that park.
When we came to Moingona before, it was to visit Kate Shelley sites. Now that you're living out in Moingona, have you learned anything new, Susan?
Oh, yes, and it's truly amazing. There's nothing in present-day Moingona that looks like it could have been here when Kate Shelley was here, including the station, and we're going to hear a little story about that later. So I got curious about what happened to the old Moingona, and I asked Pam Schwartz over at the Boone County Historical Society, who is our guide when we came to visit the Kate Shelley site, remember. She gave me the name of John Liston, who lives right across the street from the station in the Kate Shelley Park. He's also a former curator of the Boone County Historical Society with a deep knowledge of the facts and lore of Moingona.
So what did he tell you about it?
Well, in a few minutes, I'll tell you about my visit to his house, but I'll start with the artifact he showed me last week when I walked in, a Native American hand axe made from polished granite that he had found in a tree on his property. So I decided I'd like to start with the name of the town, which is obviously a Native American name. I've wondered about what the name meant, and so I asked if we could visit Dave Gradwell at his home to visit about it.
Yes, David Gradwell is a retired Iowa State professor in anthropology, but he specialized as an archaeologist, and he's done a lot of digging right here in Iowa.
Yes, that's right, and Mark was in on some of it.
Oh, yeah. So really amazing what came out of that valley.
But first I want to get back to the beginning and find out what Dave can tell us about the earliest people here and where the name Moingona came from. I'll play an excerpt from what he told us yesterday. We're exploring Moingona, the town of Moingona, and I wondered where the name came from.
I don't know exactly where it came from, but it was a name that appears on early French maps, the river of the Moingona or Moingona. And this apparently was taken from some native word, but there's a lot of controversy about the word.
So it wasn't the name of a tribe?
Not that we know of, no.
And is that the same name that's the Des Moines?
Probably was a term in one of the native languages, and then was called Des Moines or whatever by the French. There's controversy there. Some people think it means, I think, of the monks or something, but I don't think there's any creditable evidence for that.
This is a Native American site also, I believe. Not, perhaps this wasn't called by that name by the Native Americans.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure not. There are a lot of archaeological sites along that section of the Des Moines River, ranging back probably to 5,000 BC or more. We know a lot about the woodland tradition culture that existed there from maybe 300 or 400 BC up to 1,000 AD. And these were people who built mounds, grew gardens, and hunted. And then there's another archaeological complex in there around 1,000 to 1,400 AD. The Great Oasis prehistoric archaeological culture was named from a site in Minnesota. And along this section of the Des Moines River, we find Great Oasis remains, and they also grew corn and beans and squash and made pottery and hunted animals. And historically, though, we don't find the sites in this part of the Des Moines River Valley. We know the Meskwaki ranged in this area, and there are Meskwaki sites in the Des Moines area that have been found.
Well, I know there are a few Indian sites that you did some archaeology on in connection with Sailorville Lake when Sailorville
yes.
was put in. And how recent were those settlements?
Well, those were the sites I was just discussing. We did work with the National Park Service and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers trying to rescue some of the archaeological remains before they were destroyed by the building and the operation of the reservoir. There are still sites being destroyed out there now by the operation of the reservoir. But there were large sites. We spent several summers digging in the Coal Valley and Moingona.
Now, these were some of the, that's some of the work you did with Dave, wasn't it?
Well, I wasn't directly involved, but I would always kind of work my way in there where they were working. And then I had sites that I was interested in also that I'd found on my own that David and I talked about over the years, trying to share those information.
Well, you mentioned just living on the river the way people had in the past. And did you find any things along the river?
Well, related to the pottery, like, yeah, you can paddle down that Des Moines River from Highway 30 down, and as you get to Moingona on the right bank or the west bank, yeah, there's tons of pottery. You can just, there's just tons of it. The bank is just lined with it. So it's quite easy to...
And this is old pottery?
Yes, this is from that colony that was there in Moingona, the pottery colony.
Well, that's very interesting because, of course, in the town of Moingona when they had industries, and we'll get into that later. Pottery was one of them, and Dave was very excited about some of the excavation that he had done of the Moingona region for their pottery kilns. Now, as yes?
Yeah, the pottery that I'm referring to has come from those kiln areas there. Now, you have to understand that the reason that the colony is there is because of that white oak clay, which is what they're making the pottery out of. And so there's these great veins, pure veins of this clay coming out in there. So the Native Americans were using that, I'm sure, also at the time.
Well, what Dave was interested in was actually the Moingona kilns, and he has a little clip that quoted that when Gina and I were there yesterday.
Uh-huh.
There is clay that was used prehistorically and historically. We know a lot about the clays that were used by the Euro-American pioneers because good stoneware clays along the Des Moines River occurred in seams near where the coal was interbedded with where the coal deposits were. So down in Red Rock Reservoir near Coal Port, there were several kilns there. John Reynolds, one of my graduate students, did his master's thesis on that, those kilns down there. And then Alan Schroeder did his thesis on the two stoneware kilns in Moingona. And Barbara Schulte did her master's thesis on the kiln that was located at Coal Valley, just south of Highway 30.
And these were all Native American kilns?
Oh, no. They're all historic Euro-American. The Native Americans, as far as we know, did not use the same clay deposits because the ones that the early pioneers used, they found in mines. There were some exposures of those clay and coal seams on the surface, and those clays might have been used by Native Americans. I don't know of any chemical tests that have proved that, though it's pretty clear they were using prehistorically native clays. But those clay deposits near Moingona and Coal Valley in Boone County were used extensively. There were a lot of Euro-American pioneers' kilns, and they were producing primarily utilitarian vessels that would be used, storage crocks, butter churns, milk pans, things for the processing of milk products, and also putting up preserves, storing meats. I can remember my mother and my mother-in-law making pickles in stoneware crocks and so forth.
Well, thank you, Dave, for giving us that firsthand knowledge of our past. How does that coincide with your impression of the kilns from what David said?
Well, I think, you know, when you understand what's going on, say, for Coal Valley and that specific area there, they've cut pretty much all the old timber in that area. So all the trees, older trees, have been cut for either working in the mine or making the railroads as they went across there. And so there's a real change there as they're trying to dig in to follow those veins of the coal, which they're also following those veins of the clay for that pottery, like we discussed. So, you know, I think it's, as you understand the various things that are going on in that valley, it's all going on at about the same time because, you know, this culture, our white culture has come into that area, and we're transforming that landscape pretty quickly in lots of ways with the pottery and the coal mining.
Now, how do they get clay today? There's still potters using that clay here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I have a good friend, Mark Nystrom, over in Boone. That's one of the oldest potters I know, and he was getting the clay right out of the river valley there. And a lot of times you'll see it along the bank. It'll look kind of blue. You can tell clay, and the blue has more iron in it is all. But it's, you know, it's fun to make stuff out of it, and you can kind of just throw it in the fire and kind of fire it up, and it's not real high quality, but it's kind of fun to make shapes and stuff out of it. It's really good quality clay.
Have you ever found any in any of the antique shops in the area?
Yeah, I think there are. And Mark Nystrom, I know, was selling them for years and years. I think he's pretty much retired from it now, but he sold all over the state in that with that.
So. And was this a dark glaze?
He was exceptional at the glazes that he put on, but the clay itself is what they call a white oak clay, so it's kind of a white creamy color, a tannish more. And so then the glaze, they can put various colors over that.
In case you've turned in late, we're exploring Moingona, an important railroad town in the late 19th century, best known for its heroic deed of Kate Shelley, who became the heroine of Iowa when she crawled across the railroad bridge on the Des Moines River during a storm to warn the station master at the Moingona station that a bridge was out on Honey Creek. Our next guest, John Liston, will tell us about the town of Moingona in its heyday and then why it declined.
And the point of the question you ask is, how did they get here? And that's because the surveyors had to figure out a way to get across this 200-foot drop in altitude. So they had to find a way to come down through the valley and come back up. So the surveyors figured out that before that, now we've got wagon trains coming through, the roses have been here, and this has been semi-settled for about 25 years, because roses got here around 1840, and the railroad came through in about 1863 with the surveyors. And then the railroad came through around 1865. Give or take a year or two here. I'm old, my dates aren't always exact. So the surveyors tried to figure out a way to come down through here. So what they figured out was if they would come down Honey Creek, which comes through Boone and through McCoe's Park, and down through that valley, and then come on around and come out. But they had to put 68 railroad bridges across Honey Creek to get down to the Des Moines River. Then they built a single-track railroad bridge across the Des Moines River with granite and trestles and that. And then they built the railroad coming into Moingona. And here is the big reason why Moingona was important, is because it was a key mineral location. They had used all the minerals and everything they could from the Mississippi Valley, meaning hardwood, coal, timber, gravel, to lay the beds, make the railroad ties, and to feed the furnaces to run the steam engines and the steam drag lines and the steam-powered saws to get them to the Des Moines River Valley. The Des Moines River Valley was lush with hardwoods, with oak, walnut, every hardwood you can think of. It had coal, not all of it a good grade of coal. It had gravel. It had easy accessibility to all of it. So they were able to come down here and harvest this, and then they built 69 bridges between Moingona and Ogden and followed Coal Valley Creek all the way up and through and followed it around, and that goes behind now is Seven Oaks Ski Lodge. So if you're on top of Seven Oaks and turn around and look behind the ponds, you're looking down in the Coal Valley.
In the Coal Valley. Huh?
And so they followed all the way up, and then they connected just east of Ogden about 2 miles. They brought the tracks back together, and then they headed for the Missouri. And they used all the materials out of the valley to build the railroad tracks, and they hauled in the iron for the rails and the spikes. But outside of that, everything else was built here. And all the workers came from the Mississippi Valley and moved to the Moingona Valley to support the railroad. And it was enough room here, so they also inhabited Coal Valley. And when that got full, then they started inhabiting Quincy, which is just 2 miles south from here, which is a simple walk or an easy ride on the horse. So now they've gotten here, and you have to have such a large support of population to support the pottery mines, the coal, the gravel mines, the lumber mills, the railroad itself, being able to keep 4 or 5 pusher engines to be able to slow trains coming down the hills and push trains going back up the hills. Then there were so many of these slope mines, these coal slope mines around, that everybody didn't want to work for the railroad, could work for themselves and sell coal and farm. and be able to make a fairly decent living on 40 or 50 acres down here in the valley. And so then they took and used these materials to build all the trestles and all the bridges till they got clear to the Missouri River. Then around 1900, when they started building the Kate Shelley Memorial High Bridge. So Kate Shelley herself became a teacher and then became the depot master down here. And they kept it open until she retired. And when she retired, then they abandoned the line and no longer used it because it was a backup line, an emergency line, for something happened with the Kate Shelley High Bridge. You know, they only had 20, 25 years on it. They didn't know if it was going to stand up. No one had ever built a bridge that big. No one had ever built a bridge that high, that long, let alone a double-track bridge. So, but it proved that it was working. It proved that it was standing up to the weight. So there was no reason any longer to have the trains come into Mongona. And that wrote the death warrant for Mongona and people moving away because there's no longer industry here. There's no longer a way to make a paycheck.
John Liston was the man who told us that story. He actually has the distinction of living on what was once the main business district of Mongona. When he bought it in 1987, all of the original buildings were gone. The town had once been over 3,000 people, was now down to 56. And actually, he said it was a lot more than 3,000 because he was counting Coal Valley. I think it was 7,000 or 8,000 with that whole area. And, of course, that Mongona was the town for all of that. So it was a big exodus when it happened.
And what year was it when Kate Shelley retired?
It was about 10 years before they really abandoned the line. Early 30s, or 30, 32 or 33, something like that. I could never understand the Mongona Road and why it was so far from the Kate Shelley station. Well, it's because it isn't the same road.
Right.
And in fact, when I went to see John Liston in his home, he had all these wonderful maps, including the plat maps that were in his deed, because, of course, his deed is really a history of Mongona, since it shows the many, many buildings that were laid out in what is now his pasture. And he pointed out the road that crossed the river just close to the station that was a stagecoach road. First it was a ferry, and then they put a bridge in there. And I guess that there were covered wagons coming through even at the time of the railroad.
Right. And I can remember driving the road from Mongona all the way south to E-57 to pass the ledges. I mean, there used to be a road all the way down along there.
Yes, well, this was one of the conversations that we had. He'd point out, now, this is where this road went.
Yes.
And you can go over there and look at the other end, Avenue L, which is the road that we take south off of 30. That really disrupted a lot of connectivity. Because you can't get to Coal Valley directly from...
Right. Well, actually, that whole river valley has old roadbeds all the way down to Madrid that I know of. I mean, you can still find parts of them that haven't washed out, but both sides of the river had roads all the way down. I mean, they had access roads. It was amazing. And now what they do is they look like ravines now. So they're hard to recognize, but the ravine is there because the road was there and came down these slopes. So
when he was telling about following Honey Creek, 68 bridges or
right.
64 bridges,
right.
They followed the creek valley down.
Right.
And, one of the things that you mentioned earlier, and you mentioned in passing, was the deforestation of the area.
Yes. We have pictures of the ledges, say, for example, before we got it as a state park with hardly a old tree in there. I mean, it's completely clear-cut. It's cattle grazing, pasture-looking. So those are quite – at the historical building here in Boone is where I stumbled on that one. It's hard to believe. I mean, that – this whole valley essentially has been logged. It's hard to find a true old-growth tree except down in some of those deep ravines where they had a hard time getting down to those trees.
Well, there's a reverse of that, though, that's kind of funny. We live about a mile down the gravel road past Mount Mongona, so we drive past forested areas. And the funny thing there is they're what I had confirmed are old shale heaps – but they now have soil on them and fairly good-sized trees growing out of them. Right. They just don't look like natural hills. They are
The whole topography down, that's what I'm trying to say. That's what I really – the whole thing I really learned was looking at that, how altered that landscape is in that valley. I mean, all those little small ravines were like access for farm equipment to get down. And so now they've turned it – they've eroded all the way down to a sharp V at the bottom. You would not know that a road was there. But it used to be the farm access down into those lower floodplains to farm. And the coal – like you say, the piles of coal, the topography, the mountain standing there has timber on them. So you don't realize that that's just piled up stuff. I mean, that's how – altered that landscape is. It's just amazing. I can't believe it. Every time I walk in there, I see something more. A million examples of that down in there. And that's why even Gradwall's excavations are looking into those mound areas down there. There was a lot of discussion about some of those little mounds where they had just moved dirt for some other reason. They weren't burial mounds. But then there were burial mounds that weren't recorded that were tucked up into those hills also. So things really changed in that valley. I mean, it's just amazing. The coal mine, like I said, there was roads up and down all both sides of that river. Every draw, every place you could get access in and out, we had put roads in and come down into that valley.
And before that, I guess thousands of years of habitation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're saying there was people here right after the glacier. So we're looking at almost 12,000 years ago, people starting coming into this area. But you have to understand how rich an area was. I mean, that's why even the settlers, when they're first coming in and setting up these communities at Mungo, this is an extremely rich area for resources to live off, like we talked about, the wood and the heat and the coal and the building materials, but also the food, the plums, the cherries. You know, all these kinds of food sources are here also.
And so, you didn't even mention the hunting, which is still prominent in the valley. The Kate Shelley Park is public hunting, which made me nervous when we were walking down there. I thought, this is spring. I don't know whether I want to walk out here in the fall.
That public space gets a lot of use, a lot of kinds.
John was saying how even the railroad station had burned down after a little while, and then when he was away in the Army, the Boone Historical Society replaced the old station by moving in one from Beaver.
Yes, and he's from Beaver. This is a terrific little story. Play it.
But I lived in Beaver at the time, just before I went to the military, and the Kate Shelley Park Museum Railroad Depot was in Beaver. Yeah. And I remember the depot being there, and I remember getting 10 cents to watch the depot while Don Slock went over to the bar and had his lunch, and then came back over and watched the depot and picked up the mail because the mail was delivered by Saks. And the funny part is my ex-wife's uncle used to do the same thing when he was a teenager and a young boy, and he would get a nickel. And he carved his name in the telegraph window over here in the park. And the initials are DT. And you can still find them in there. And he's original Beaver boy, same as I am. And I think it's a unique situation that the depot has followed me all the way down here. Then my wife and her uncle's initials followed me too. And she showed those to me. And
it is so personal.
Yes, personal ties to place. They're so important.
Susan, you have been mentioning that there's two coal towns. What's the other one, and what's its connection to Moingona?
Well, the town is Buxton, though it wasn't in our listening area. But there are three reasons about talking about it today. One is that it has a remarkable history to celebrate during Black History Month. Second, David Gradwall did an extensive archaeological study of it and described it to us when we visited him yesterday. And third, was the man who planned this remarkable community, Ben Buxton, must have been from Boone because his father, John E. Buxton, was president of the Boone School Board. And he also was president of an agricultural society in East Boone County. So he's from this area. And I'll play Dave's response to my statement that Buxton wasn't an incorporated town.
It was an organized, planned community of 5,000 to 6,000. with public buildings. They had two YMCAs, a company store, several hotels. This does not fit the definition of a coal camp by any means. And Iowa State University had good fortune to be able to spend two summers working at the Buxton town site doing archaeology. And our purpose was to gather data that would demonstrate that the site was eligible for inclusion on the National Register of Historic Sites.
Was it?
Well, absolutely. The interesting thing is I was on the state review board at that time for sites going on the National Register, and I felt there, before we even went out there, there was enough data to put it on the National Register. But if the National Park Service wanted to provide money for archaeological field work there to gather more data, I was only too happy to oblige. And it was fascinating for the students and for me to be able to explore Iowa's black history through archaeology. We knew at the time precious little about Iowa's black history. And the resources there are huge, as we know now.
Yes, they were huge both archaeologically and, at that time, sociologically.
Oh, absolutely. And archivally, the Iowa State Bystander was a black newspaper that operated from the 1890s up till a few years ago. I think it's defunct now. But this newspaper is a treasure trove of the black history of Iowa. And they had a lot about Buxton because they'd have articles about different towns where blacks lived, and they would report it. And they had one continuing column about Buxton. The name of the column was Buxton Briefs, which always sounded like an underwear ad to me, but wonderful information on what was going on in the town of Buxton.
Well, I noticed in the index of Dorothy Schreeder's book on Buxton, the names of five newspapers. One, of course, was the Bystander, but four of them were actually Buxton papers, and I didn't read to see how long they were in existence.
Well, and we don't have runs for most of those, just a few, but yes, there were newspapers run by blacks in Buxton. Our work on Buxton totally blew my stereotypes about black history in Iowa, because there were black physicians and dentists and pharmacists and teachers and superintendents. They were doing all of these jobs in addition to being coal miners.
It's kind of interesting to compare the two towns, Moingona and Buxton. Moingona had more blacksmiths, but Buxton had more milliners and hotels.
And then both had doctors, dentists, but Moingona had brickyards and a boatyard.
Yes, Moingona had a skating rink, but Buxton had a YMCA with a swimming pool.
And both had people who farmed and mined, though Buxton's miners all worked at the Consolidated Coal Company, while some of Moingona were independent with slope mines.
Yes, that's right. But the biggest difference, of course, was that Buxton had an important black cultural community. And an integrated community. Moingona was and is an all-white town as far as we can tell.
Yep. Completely different than Buxton.
No, there was a black community over in Coal Valley.
Yes.
Which had a derogatory name that we won't say on the radio. Right. But that was
separated quite a bit, too. I
mean, so you're familiar with that area?
Yes, yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I knew people that lived in Coal Valley that have since died. But, yeah, them telling the stories, what they'd heard. It was quite separate communities.
And when Dave and Dorothy Schreeder did their work in Buxton, they talked to a lot of the old residents. I think Dorothy Schreeder had 75 interviews.
Yeah.
And the people who left Buxton and went to work in the area around Ogden weren't very happy.
Yeah.
So far, we have been talking about the past in our area. One of the things I discovered as I was doing research for this program was our entire listening area, all the way up to Hardin and Webster counties, is sitting on coal deposits. The coal region extends south to the bottom of tier of counties in Iowa, which is where Buxton is, Monroe County. This is an important part of Iowa's energy economy of the past that most present-day Iowans are unaware of. The last part of our program will deal with an energy source that may possibly be transported through our state by means of a huge pipeline. Some people in Boone County think this is a danger and are organizing a meeting next Sunday, March 28th, to talk about it. I had an interview with April Birch, one of the leading organizers, to tell us why she thinks it's important. And our guest today, Mark Edwards, I believe, is also on that organizing committee.
Yes, I am.
You're a guest of the station.
Yes, so I can speak freely.
Shall we hear what April has to say?
April can set the context.
I've lived in Boone most of my life. I was born and raised here, all the way back to my great-great and possibly great three-greats grandparents who settled out near the Des Moines River at Fraser and were farmers for a few generations. So when I moved back home in 2011 from working and going to college, I immediately plugged into the environmental community here. As you probably well know, Iowa is the most biologically altered state in the union. So it's a bit of a challenge because I had come from college in the Pacific Northwest where we were fighting for pristine forests, old growth redwood forests, old growth Sitka spruce, Douglas fir forests. And coming home, you're like, well, what do we need to protect here? And one of the biggest issues that I saw originally when I moved home was this new situation where the Iowa Agricultural Board is responsible for self-monitoring of water quality issues related to farming in Iowa. Previously, I know that the Department of Natural Resources was responsible for managing that through volunteer efforts, and water quality monitoring was done much more regularly and stringently. When I just kind of lost sight of issues because there weren't a lot of issues that were happening when I first moved home, other than, you know, the persistent water quality and commercial agriculture CAFO issues that were coming up. And I was supporting those as much as I could. And then I heard about the Bakken pipeline. I did not really hear much about it until the spring of 2015. And at that time, there were a few people working with CCI out of Des Moines, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, on educating the public, getting objections to the Iowa Utilities Board signed. And we had Nathan Malachowski come from ICCI. And Nathan came and we started working on gathering objections. And we went to the farmers market and reached out to people and found that we had a number of people in the Boone area that were strongly opposed on a variety of grounds. Some of the biggest opposition comes from the idea of possible farmland and water resource contamination. Other objections that are equally as strong come from the idea of using eminent domain for the gain of a private endeavor. Because as we've learned throughout the proceedings, there is very little benefit to the people of Iowa in this project. There's very little benefit to working people, period. I met with Leuna. I met with one of the Leuna organizers.
And what are the initials on that so we can...
uppercase L. And he had said that there were, you know, 23 some odd workers in Boone County that he represented.
Mm-hmm.
Not all would be potential pipeline workers. So for Boone County to accept all of this risk for less than a couple dozen jobs that are short-term, short-lived jobs in the first place, it seems like an astronomical amount of risk to ask the people of Boone County, to ask the people of Iowa to accept. So we met with Tom Foster and Greg Picklap, who was a city council member, was also there. And we discussed the Board of Supervisors writing a resolution against the Bakken mm-hmm. pipeline. And they had talked about taking the route that Calhoun County took in writing a very prescriptive resolution mm-hmm. detailing exactly what the people, what Dakota Access would have to do to comply mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. their local mm-hmm. requirements. And we felt like it's not really the time for that. We feel like it's the time to just say no. Once the IUB approves and we're backed into a corner with this, you can write another resolution. But right now, I think that, you know, time is of the essence. We don't want to give a tacit approval, because that's what you're actually doing when you're saying, okay, you can do it, but you have to follow this set of rules and these prescriptions for doing this, that, and the other. And you'll have these fines and all of that. That's tacit approval, something that they can work within. And our feeling was that we don't want this. It's not a benefit to Iowans. We don't want to set up a system that they can game from the outset. So the Boone County Board of Supervisors met as a group, and they took our ideas and expounded upon them. They added in their concerns about the drainage districts. That's one of their primary responsibilities with the supervisors, is to maintain and protect the drainage districts, the drainage tiles for farmlands in Boone County. So when the supervisors met to give their resolution, to approve their resolution a few weeks later, they approved this resolution that they had put together unanimously, with objections to eminent domain for private gain, objections to the minimal surety bond required by the state of Iowa, $250,000. They objected to unforeseen potential impacts to our emergency rescue services in the event of a catastrophe. And they objected to damage to the drainage tiles. So they objected on a number of levels, and it was really quite something, because none of the other counties did this. None of the other county board of supervisors did this. And after that, we felt a little empowered, but basically it came down to they just registered the objection at the hearings, and that was it. It was a line item, essentially. So now we're at this point where, you know, we're all just waiting. We're waiting to see what the IUB says. And when you look at the history of corporate law in the United States, when you look at the history of regulatory agencies and their interactions with corporations, you very rarely see a regulatory agency that will actually stop a corporate activity from happening due to harm, due to potential harm. You very rarely see that. They'll put restrictions on the activity to some extent. They'll put fines. They'll impose requirements on the activity. But it's very rare to see a regulatory agency like the Iowa Utilities Board to just come out and say, no, we're not going to allow this corporate activity for X, Y, and Z reasons. So we're all kind of waiting with bated breath, but the expectation is that the Iowa Utilities Board will approve this pipeline, ultimately. And we knew that when we scheduled this People's Forum on the Bakken pipeline. We wanted to give people an opportunity to see that an Iowa Utilities Board approval is not the end-all be-all. It is not the end of the road. We do not have to accept that the Bakken pipeline will move forward just because an unelected three-person commission decides that they are authorized to move forward with this. These people are appointed. They're not elected officials. Sure, they were appointed by an elected official whose popularity and interests in the protection of Iowans seems to be dwindling with each passing day. And our concern is that these people, you know, they're appointed by a governor whose motivations are in question. You know, did he accept $1 million, some odd amount of money in campaign contributions through Rick Perry's organizations in Texas, through Energy Transfer Partners? Did this happen? There's a lot of speculation. I don't know the answers right off the top of my head, but there are a lot of people who have come forward and said that there's definitely impropriety afoot here. So across the United States right now, there's work going on in the legal community to say, stop this corporate rights malarkey. This is not what our Constitution originally prescribed. We have all of these interpretations of law going back to the mid-1800s, ascribing rights to corporations, the contracts and clauses section is mostly owned by U.S. corporations now. We don't have a lot of protections there for normal people, for everyday people. So this community rights ordinance movement, and it is a movement. There are over 200 communities in 9 states across the U.S. that have enacted these ordinances to protect their communities from predominantly environmental harm. But I think that they could also go so far as to protect public health. Like right now, I think the city of Flint, Michigan is pretty ripe for a community rights ordinance requiring that the people are allowed to represent themselves, that they are allowed to move forward in their best interests. Because what we see again and again right now is we see these high-ranking elected officials and their subordinates who are moving on very political grounds. They're not moving on public responsibility grounds. They're not doing things to protect the public. They're doing things to protect their office. They're doing things to protect their donations, their contributors, the corporations that support them. And everyday people are suffering. And it's not right. So what we're looking at in Boone is the creation of a community rights ordinance that basically says, we the people have the power of self-governance. It is given to us through our Constitution. And when our elected officials fail at protecting us and protecting our interests, we have the right to govern ourselves. And we don't have to wait for elections to elect a new person into office to represent us. We have the right to say, as a municipality, this is what we want. This is the protection that we require, since the state level is not protecting us. And right now, in saying that, we're going against matters of settled law. Right now, we have a matter of settled law that essentially says that the state has preemptive power over any municipality's decisions. Municipalities are not allowed to make laws that the state does not approve. It's basically a parent-child relationship with a township or a county as the child and the state as the parent. Well, what we're saying is that our parents are not doing their job. So we are enacting our rights to say we will protect ourselves. We will write an ordinance that states we don't want the Bakken pipeline in Boone County. It's too much of a risk. There's very little reward to any of us, and the risk is exorbitant.
Mark, Mark's on the committee. Can you tell what's going to happen on the 28th?
Yeah, we're going to have a forum up front, and Ed Fallon, who's been a past legislature, Iowa legislator, and activist on the global climate change discussion, is going to be there. Daniel Wanatee from the Meskwaki tribe is going to be there. Tom Foster from the Boone County Supervisors. Danielle Wirth, ISU and Drake professor, is going to speak about various issues related to this. We have some landowner representation by Dan Gannon. And then we have Paulson Fuegos has come from out of state who represents this community rights, helping to organize this so that we can look at our self-government. Because I think looking back at our history we've been talking about today with Buxton and Mongona, there's two different ways that these places organize themselves and came up with ways to live together. And I think we have a choice here looking forward. And April really got this explained it very well, because that Iowa Utilities Board, which is appointed by the governor, only needs 2 of the 3 to approve this permit. And if you look at eminent domain, the history of eminent domain has changed in the last few years, where it used to be that was public things like roads and communications and things like that. But now it's stepped off into private business, which is the Bakken Pipeline is a private business coming through Iowa. So the law changed when it out on the East Coast, they redefined eminent domain to move hundreds of people off of their land to build a shopping center. And that was where things started moving into private business, having more power than the public. And so this question of what is the public rights? How do we feel about that? I've been shocked in Boone of how many people have really stepped up, and especially working with the Boone County Supervisors, they're amazing. I mean, there's something inherent in us that know that we have to protect the place we live, which has been true for thousands of years here. And so when we talk about the past, the transformation of the timber and the coal and everything, I don't think people can imagine what would happen if we have an oil leak on that Des Moines River, because that drains two-thirds of the state of Iowa, and it affects communities all the way down the river. So like Boone, for example, gets its water from shallow wells right along the edge of the river. It would be devastating to us. We have no idea, except from the flood from 93 when Des Moines, you know, their water plant shut down and everybody had to drink bottled water. So, I mean, we can't even comprehend what the ramifications of this would be, let alone the legality and how we define ourselves in our community and what's important to us. And so I'm really excited to have this discussion. I think we see this spreading across the country, as April referred to, and it's time that we look at this local control of where we live.
And where and when?
Okay, Sunday the 28th, it's at the Boone High School, which is easy to find, and it's from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock. And then we have a follow-up thing on Tuesday the 1st of March, and that will be from 6 to 9 on Downtown Street, 723 Story Street in Boone. And then we have other things going on across the state. I know of some in Des Moines. There's three-day workshops there. There's Rockwell City doing this. And I'm part of a larger coalition. There's 30 different organizations that have come together over this to discuss this Bakken pipeline and try to figure out what are we going to do about this, because we could find no benefit for Iowa except for a month-long labor working. And so we're very concerned how it could have ever got this far and go this fast. That's the other part. I've attended all the meetings. I've been to all the hearings. I've read all the transcripts, everything. They're not even doing an environmental or cultural assessment of where this pipeline is going, except where they have to by law on public land, which is a very small percent of where this pipeline is going. So here we'd have an opportunity to learn lots of things about where we live, but not going to get it.
Well, and we'll have some postings on our website, and I think you can help us with that.
Sure, sure. So, we'll make sure all that gets on there.
It's now time to say goodbye. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts for today, Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Mark Edwards was our studio guest, and we heard from David Gradwall, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology from ISU, John Liston, Keeper of Moingona History, and April Birch, Advocate for Citizens' Rights in Boone.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Richard Morrison. Today is our very favorite theme song, backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production, training workshop, as well as a show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or you can also contact us through our website at khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.